Hello and welcome to Talking Scared. I'm your host, Neil McRobert, and this week, I promise you, everyone survives. And that's no mean feat, because there are quite a few of us in this conversation. Would have been easy to lose somebody. I'm joined by editors and contributors from the brand new horror anthology, The Black Girl Survives, in this one. It's a collection of stories that makes that one single promise, but confounds expectations in a host of other ways. It's edited by Ceresia J. Fennell and Desiree S. Evans, who both contribute their own stories amongst the creme of contemporary black horror writers, two of whom, Eden Royce and Monica Brashears, are also part of this conversation. You'll be glad to hear that, for once, I remember to point out early which voice belongs to who, and I will say there is a range of audio quality on this one, and I do apologise if it's not quite up to its usual standard, but the conversation definitely makes up for it. Together, we talk about the need for and purpose of this anthology as a whole, and we dig a little into each of their stories to begin mapping this vibrant corner of horror fiction. And we do talk about the difference between survival and living happily ever after. Remember, if you want more Talking Scared, sign up for Patreon. It's patreon.com/talkingscaredpod, or use the link in the show notes. You're helping out and you're getting bonus stuff. It's a win-win. And all reviews on Apple, Spotify or wherever are warmly received. But now, come with me to the cornfield cemeteries and high school hallways of America. There are girls to meet with monsters to defeat. Let's talk scared. Well, hello and welcome to Talking Scared. Desiree, Ceresia, Eden, Monica, how are you all today?
Doing well.
Doing well.
Happy to be here.
Excited to be here as well.
Thank you so much for taking the time to come talk to me about The Black Girl Survives in this one. This is a much anticipated anthology of horror stories that centre young black women in a more empowering light than the genre has often provided. There's an awful lot to dig into about the contents and context of this book today. But because there are four of you, and this is a purely audio medium, my listeners need to know who you are and what your voices sound like. So I'm going to ask you to do a quick introduction. Tell us who you are, and if you could, give us the title and a very quick couple of lines about your story. So, Ceresia, do you mind starting?
Absolutely. I'm Ceresia J. Fennell. I am one of the co-editors of the anthology, and my story is called Cemetery Dance Party. It features a girl who is on the track team, and she has an injury, but she's also the senior class president, so she's tasked with planning sort of the senior party. She decides that she wants to host it in a cemetery, which is fantastic. There's an undead situation that takes place. And so she and some of her friends basically spend the evening trying to fight for their survival, battling the undead, which is really fun.
It is a fun story. It is. It's the most comedic of the four we'll talk about tonight. So over to you, Desiree.
Hello, my name is Desiree S. Evans. I am the other co-editor of the anthology. My story in the collection is called The Brides of Devil's Bayou, which I use to kind of metaphorically explore how trauma is passed down in families, particularly Black families. Aja, who's my final girl, is caught up in a powerful family curse where she has to defeat her family's demon.
And listeners, for reasons you know well by now, this story freaked me out. We'll get into that. Monica.
I am Monica Brashears, author of the story The Skittering Thing, which takes place during a strange slumber party game, and it is revealed that something lives within the caves surrounding the house. It sort of explores religious trauma and generational trauma.
Yeah, that one is absolute nightmare fuel. One particular detail that we've already discussed off air that left me with sort of toe-curling sensations. Eden, finish us off with your bio and your story.
Hi, everyone. My name is Eden Royce, and I am the author of the story Local Color, in which a young girl, Verone, is haunted by the disappearance of her parents. And in searching for them, stumbles upon a journal that details a monster from my culture that is a shapeshifter that she doesn't heed the warnings about how she can avoid it during her search.
Yeah, and that one I particularly like because I'm always into new folkloric entities that I'm not aware of. So we can hopefully talk about that in due course. So that's my four guests. I'll do the awkward thing, listeners, and reiterate people's voices as we go along, just so you're fully abreast of it. But let's get into it because this book is full of rich delights. It opens with the ultimate accolade, a foreword from the Queen herself, Tanana Reeve Dhu. She's a friend of the show and someone that I think we all hold in the highest esteem. In that intro, she writes, and this is a direct quote, "The Black Girl Survives in This One is a groundbreaking project that rebukes and revises black women's invisibility and servitude in horror." So let's start there, because that is quite the summation, I suppose. Is that a claim you recognise, that invisibility and servitude in the genre? Does it capture what you each think of as the mission of these stories in this book?
This is Desiree. Absolutely. You know, I think when we were coming up with this idea, when Cerise and I were coming up with a theme for the anthology, we landed on this idea of final girls, right? There had been a lot kind of in the cultural zeitgeist talking about final girls, a lot of books about final girls recently, but none of them had really done an effective job of really addressing this issue of like, well, what about black final girls? Hmm. You know, a lot of our favorite final girls from horror movies, from slashers of the 70s and 80s were white women, white teenagers who, you know, went up against great horrific evil and came out on the other side. But so often we didn't see women like ourselves or teenage girls like ourselves, black girls. And when we did, we were like maybe the best friend or a character that was quickly killed off. We never really got that kind of in-depth exploration and centering that we so desired, you know? And this was our chance to really kind of talk about, well, what if we center black girls? What if they are the heroes and the heroines and the survivors? And what would happen if we kind of reframe the story through that lens?
Absolutely. Cerisia here. And I just want to quickly add with Desiree, I think, you know, she and I grew up both horror lovers. And when we connected over this project, like you know, like she said, we kept coming back to this idea of the black final girl and just really wanting to curate a project that featured so many different diverse stories within the horror genre, and then tapping in, you know, all of these writers and having them bring their own perspective to the genre, which was really, really cool to see. And I hope that this anthology acts as a gateway for other writers to kind of say like, oh, you know, there can be a black final girl in this story. And maybe we should shake up the notion of what's out there because people are craving these stories. You know, I hope that there's more diversity that ends up in the horror genre. I think speculative fiction overall just has very been a majorly white space. And so this was sort of us carving ourselves back into the genre. And then to have someone like Tanana Reeve Dhu, I mean, what a dream come true for her to pen that forward for us. Because like you said, she is a queen of the genre. So we were floored when she said yes.
Yeah, I'm a huge fan of Tanana Reeves. I do a thing every year where I rank my 10 favorite reads of the year. And last year, The Reformatory won by A Country Mile. But to stick with Sarita and Desiree for a second as the editors, when you first came together to shape this idea and you started approaching writers, what was your brief that you gave out?
I think the first thing we did was try and make sure we had a balance of writers. We wanted to make sure that we had some folks who, you know, already write YA, but we also wanted to bring in some authors who also write adult books, or authors who maybe were writing dark fantasy and kind of like tiptoeing on the cusp of horror. So we were really excited to bring together those folks. And then I would love for Desiree to talk about sort of this one sheet that she was able to provide all of the contributors, because I think it also helped, you know, help them see that, oh, I could go really wide and within the horror genre. It didn't just have to be, you know, a slasher or about zombies or vampires. You could dig deeper. Do you want to talk about that, Desiree?
Yeah, this is Desiree. We provided what I call the map, a map of the horror, that's all of its subgenres, to each of the contributors, to kind of give them an idea, to taste of all the variety of stories they can tell, you know, from psychological horror to creature features to ghosts to gothic. You know, there's just so much under the horror genre that's out there. We often kind of get in our mind, particularly when we think of final girls, we probably only think of slashers, but really the final girl can exist in a variety of forms. We can have space offer. We can think of people like Ripley and Alien. There's so much out there that can be done. So we kind of wanted to provide them with that kind of landscape to kind of get the juices flowing, so they can really think about like, what out of the expanse that horror is, can I write my final girl as? What things can she be up against in a variety of ways? And the writers came back with some really great ideas.
Well, yeah, because there are a ton of stories that, you know, we probably won't cover today because they're written by people who aren't guests. But I was making a list as I went along. There was L.L. McKinney's Harvester is this all-American cornfield nightmare. What else? Courtney Nash's Welcome Back to the Cosmos is a sci-fi space opera thing, as you mentioned. Zakiya Dalila Harris, who is a past guest and an author that I love, writes a story called TMI, which reads like a really scary episode of sort of Black Mirror technophobia. Who else? Is it the Moolit sisters, Micah and Maritza? They offer Black Girl Nature Group, which is complete pure adventure horror. Were you surprised by the variety in the stories that you received?
Sarisia here again. No, I was not surprised. I was actually really excited, because I think going in, I was just really nervous that everyone would probably come up with kind of the same thing, like, you know, like a slasher or a zombie or vampires or werewolves, kind of those. But to see the diversity that we got, it was awesome from the very beginning. The only thing I kept discussing with Desiree was like, I want them to up the ante a little bit. I want this to be a little bit scarier, or I want the, you know, the main character to go through a few more challenges before we reach the end. So that was really the only feedback that I had for most of the stories. I was like, let's really put the girl through the ringer, because we know at the end she's going to survive anyway. So let's just go there.
Yeah.
We're really interested in doing that, because I think sometimes we think that, you know, young adult fiction or middle grade fiction can't be too scary. But, you know, for folks who are familiar with YA and middle grade horror, we can really get scary. We can really get deep into a lot of, you know, emotional, cathartic issues that, you know, preteens and teens go through. And so we really wanted to give folks the freedom to really like up the scares, to really address the traumas they really want to bring up on the page, because teenagers, they got stuff. They got stuff that they're dealing with. And horror is a place that they could really go to really kind of to experience and to figure out how to really face their fears and demons.
Mm-hmm. And you do. I mean, as I've already mentioned in those few brief intros, there are details in some of these stories that are genuinely unsettling, genuinely frightening. And I want to talk about all the things you've mentioned, you two, but I think it's only fair to bring in Monica and Eden, who are contributors and not editors. Monica, Eden, what were your first thoughts when you got the brief, when you thought about this project? Was there already like a story just there burning that you wanted to tell, or did you have to find it if we start with you, Eden.
Oh, of course we're starting with me. Well, I was excited, number one, to be invited to participate in the anthology, especially once I heard about some of the names that were involved. And it was just an exciting thing to be a part of because I've loved horror for a long time. And getting the chance to pen my own final girl was a thrill. I think one of my challenges with it, though, is too many ideas, too many ways and too many routes you could go, because I feel like the genre is really underserved with Black final girls and stories that really bring to the fore our experiences. So the hardest thing for me was settling on an idea of the many that just sort of started bubbling to the surface when I got that email.
I, too, was, so excited. I'd been reading broadly and making an effort to read stories and novels that I wouldn't necessarily reach for on my own. So it had been a while since I'd been in the horror genre mentally. And so it felt nice returning to my roots because I sort of grew up on like Stephen King. It was all my mom had in the house. And I knew immediately that I wanted to write about this nightmare I kept having. The first iteration featuring John Hamm as the cult leader and this skittering thing that would always appear. John Hamm fell off, but the skittering thing continues to haunt me still in my nightmares.
Is there something you find particularly frightening about John Hamm?
I haven't unpacked that yet. I'll let you know.
Okay, so we've talked a lot about final girls already. This survival aspect, I mean, it's in the title, survival. I'm interested both from an editorial sense and from a story writing sense. Why was that so crucial? Because I understand the desperate need for an anthology of fiction that centers young Black women. Why was it so important that they survived?
I think one of the things that Cerise and I, this is Desiree, spoke about when we kind of were drafting the proposal to send out to an editor is that, for one, we wanted it to be YA. We wanted it to be young adult because we were both teen horror book lovers, right? And a lot of the the movies of the 70s and 80s were about these white teenage girls who are up against these, you know, horrific situations. And so we thought the YA, which has like these amazing, powerful heroines at the center of so many books, this would be a great place to have that story, that horror story of Black girls surviving. And it came at a time when we were seeing a great push for more diversity across the board, but also YA fiction was really on the forefront of really seeing more diverse books coming, seeing Black writers get that opportunity and chance to write, particularly in speculative genres. And so this seemed to be a kind of a combination of all those things happening at once that really kind of led us to this idea, okay, what if it's a Black girl at the center? And what if she survives? Because right now we're, you know, in the U.S., we were so caught up in this, in what was happening, the protests, the movement for Black Lives, Say Her Name. We were talking about the violence, the racism, the anti-Black violence that was happening against Black bodies. We were also trying to talk about the violence that was happening to Black women and girls. And the fact that, you know, so often when Black women and girls would disappear or something would happen to them, their stories would go untold. You wouldn't hear about them in the news. Mm-hmm. And so this was kind of an opportunity to really talk about, wait a second, let's focus in on Black girl survival, because that survival isn't guaranteed. There's something so powerful to see people like you surviving when you're coming from a dominant culture where so often your life hasn't been valued. And so for me, in a lot of ways, I wanted to write about Black Final Girls because I wanted to see Black women and girls surviving and getting through to the other side.
Absolutely. And then just quickly, in addition to that, the title is so meta. It's such a meta title. You know, we've had so many reviewers who have been reading this book and they're like, I'm so happy with the title because it lets you know, okay, this is a horror collection, but we know that there are going to be some horrific things that happen, some scary, spooky things, but we know that the character is going to survive at the end. So I think it's been a really fantastic tool to invite people who don't necessarily read horror, but maybe are interested in Black stories. And so there's a nice, you know, sort of gateway for those folks to come in. And then for those like staunch horror fans to be like, okay, this is a horror collection, but finally we're going to see Black Final Girls at the end. So I'm excited to see the collection of stories that are in here and what these characters are about to go through. So I think it's both, you know, reacting to things that were happening in the real world, but also kind of tapping into readers' specific niche and their interests, while at the same time, like inviting people who just love championing Black stories to say, okay, finally, we know that just because of going off of the title that these girls are going to survive at the end, which has been really cool to see because so many people have tagged us saying like, I don't necessarily read horror, but you know, it's Black girls and I read it and this was great. It was fantastic. I was able to get through the collection and I'm just so happy to see that.
Mm-hmm. It's like a positive content warning, right? You know, this is not the, it's not like saying, oh, be careful, these really bad things happen. It's like saying, actually, some okay things, outcomes happen in this collection, in this anthology. Eden, Monica, do you have any thoughts on that overall theme about survival?
For me, coming from the background that I do, culturally, it is such a deep part of the person that I am and the writer that I am, weaving in not only my personal experiences and my style of writing, but also being conscious of what our people have endured over the centuries in the United States and in different parts of the world. And survival and endurance is woven into our fabric. And I think that's something that really is, that really comes out in the stories and in the collection as a whole. And specifically for me, weaving in folklore with that, making sure that people are aware of historically what we've been through, but also realizing that there are still current and relevant pains and struggles that we do go through. And a lot of the horror that I've written, certainly novel length, has been for younger readers, has been for the middle grade market. And I wanted to touch a little bit on what Desiree, I believe it was, said earlier. People sometimes think that stories for younger audiences can't delve into horror and can't reflect stressful or traumatic or difficult experiences. And a lot of times horror is a way for us to process what's happening and what has happened to us. And I think a lot of those stories in the collection really focus on survival through whatever we come across so that readers as well as other authors can realize that we can endure and we can get through anything. And I think that's the theme of a lot of the work included.
Yeah, this is Desiree. I wanted to speak to that a little bit. You know, for so many folks, horror, like I was saying earlier, is a way through, right? We can kind of vicariously experience some of our worst fears, but at the end of the day, we can close the book, we can turn off the TV. We know that, you know, there's going to be a final girl that makes it out at the end. When we think back to this idea of Black women surviving, and that idea that Sorcee and I talked a lot about is that, you know, on a day-to-day basis, Black women and girls face so much, you know. Eden talks about endurance, right? I was thinking a lot of the stories touch on this kind of underlying fear and terror that Black girls go through this hypervigilance that they have in order to kind of get through the day, right? To fight, to be seen, to be heard, to be believed, to be listened to. And so it almost makes Black girls natural, like a natural survival instinct towards being a final girl, because we're already, you know, on a daily basis kind of fighting our way through and trying to make it through to the other side. And so when you kind of put someone who's already going through so much in the real world as a center of a story that is about how do you survive and how does this girl survive, it felt like a natural fit in so many ways. But yeah.
And what I found interesting, though, is how few of these stories sort of dramatized real-world horrors. They were very speculative, very imaginative, looked away almost universally from, you know, the state of what's going on in the Western world right now with the return of repressive politics and all of that stuff. They seem to embrace a real the fun of the genre, I suppose. Do you agree?
This is Eden. I do agree. And one of the reasons that I think it's so such a brilliant thing to embrace more of the speculative is we're all inundated every day with what's going on in the world and in the news. And being able to reflect our experiences without having to directly reference those things and being able to craft and create a speculative story that may have some basis or may have some inspiration in what's happening in the real world is such a powerful thing sometimes, because people can open themselves up to a story that's speculative sometimes a little bit more than they can with real world situations all the time. Mm-hmm. Because there's this, I always call it with horror, and particularly with well-crafted horror, which I think these stories are, there's a way that these stories beguile you as a reader. Mm-hmm. They really draw you in, because initially you may not always suspect where the horror is coming from. You may not always realize exactly what's going to happen. And a lot of that allure comes from that unpredictability. There are different monsters. The monsters approach differently. The horror presents itself differently. And that is one of the beautiful things about this collection and the stories that Desiree and Theresia have chosen.
Yes, I'm thinking of, Eden, what you said on people being more open to the speculative sometimes, and the power in these stories being based in real events or real concerns. And I think also there's something about like the speculative manifesting as a way, when people are dismissed, it's usually like, oh, it's not that serious. But the, I don't know, I don't really have the language to say what I'm trying to say. I'm sorry. but the appearance of the horror, like how they manifest, is sort of a demand to be heard in a way, like it is this bad. Yeah, I've just lost my connection to language, so apologies there.
Well, you've both used the word speculative, Eden and Monica, and the front page of this book specifically states that these are horror stories. Unexpected horror, as you pointed out, but horror stories. I've been thinking back over recent years, and Black female horror writing, I think, is often presented as more free-roaming than otherwise. So it's there's terms like speculative fiction, Afrofuturism, dark fantasy. I'm thinking of writers like, obviously, Octavia Butler, Neddy Okorafor, Helen Oyeyemi, writers who either don't want to be or aren't permitted to be writers of horror with a capital H. Was it really important in this anthology to make that horror with a capital H so central to the project?
Yes, it was for me. I teach at the university level Black speculative fiction classes often. And one of the things that I've talked about in my classes is that for so long, you know, Black writers in general, but Black women have not been allowed into horror. You know, we kind of take on the larger speculative realm, with a lot of horror-esque and horror-adjacent work that some of the best science fiction and fantasy Black women writers have mm-hmm. had as part of their collections. You mentioned people like Nettie and Octavia. But for so long, it was just a door that felt very closed. And I really wanted to invite, as part of the contributors, but also into the conversation, this idea that so many of us would love to write horror if we knew that we had the opportunity to do so, right? And so that was kind of part of what I was thinking of as in terms of who we were going to invite to be a part of the collection, folks who were horror writers, but also folks who had written fantasy and in other kind of speculative genres, to really have this opportunity to write horror with a capital H and to see themselves as part of this genre that for a long time was mostly cis white men, you know, and to really think about the doors that have been opening for Black writers in this genre over the last 5 to 7 years, you know, thinking about what, you know, Jordan Peele's Get Out opened up for so many of us, light on so much work that had already been done for years, but had gone kind of under-resourced and ignored by a lot of mainstream publishing. And so, and among those writers were a lot of Black women. And mm-hmm. so when I think about people like Joelle Gomez, who is writing the Gilda stories, when I think about so many short story writers, with Black women writers, when I think about when I first read Eden's work and her short story collections, as somebody who loves the Southern Gothic, which is a place that Black women have been writing in for generations, but had really kind of gone, again, unrecognized. I think about people like Gloria Naylor's Mama Day. I think about Toni Morrison's Beloved, you know, and mm-hmm. I think about how we can talk about those works as works of Gothic horror and speculative fiction outside of just kind of thinking of them as literary Black women stories. And so kind of bringing Black women back into the conversation and putting us into a historical context that we've always been writing horror in some way, and to like, let's recognize that.
It's so true, especially about Beloved. I compiled a list a few years ago for a magazine about what I consider to be the greatest horror novels ever written. And I put Beloved in the top 10 because it is. And the most reaction I got was to people saying that Beloved either wasn't a horror novel or they had never thought of it as a horror novel. And I was like, it's about a woman who is haunted by the ghost of the child that her own child that she kills. Like, what genre do you want to put it in? I mean, it's the most, one of the most horrifying novels I've ever read. But there does seem to be that knee-jerk thing to silo Black female writers, as you say, inside either a different adjacent genre or just as literary figures. It does seem to be a really ongoing impulse that I don't quite understand.
This is Eden. I've suffered with that as well. And this was probably, I don't know, maybe 10 years ago now. There was a book that came out at the time called 60 Black Women in Horror. And it was compiled by Sumiko Salson, who's also a Black woman horror author. And when my first short story came out in this anthology, and I was asked by a local bookstore to give a reading. So I was incredibly thrilled by it. It was the first time. So there were also some nerves. And I stand up there at this podium to read. And afterwards, there was a short Q&A. And I mentioned that I'm featured in this book. 60 Black Women in Horror Writing. And someone in the audience, you know, jokingly said, well, I didn't know there were 60 Black women that wrote, much less wrote horror. And I think in the moment I responded in a way that was appropriate for the situation, probably sarcastically in some manner. And that book, which has now been expanded to, I believe, 100 Black Women in Horror Writing, it goes back to a lot of literary figures that people don't think about as being horror. And one of those books, I believe it's probably a novella, looking at the length, but is called Of One Blood by Pauline Hopkins, which was, I believe, published in 1891. And reading that book really sort of spurred me on to do a lot of research. And at the time, I was writing for a now defunct publication called Graveyard Shift Sisters. And I did a 31 days of Black women in horror writing. And I did sort of a one person each day at the time for their blog. And the number of people that responded and went, either that they didn't know about the writer, they didn't know about the work, or they had never thought of that book as particularly being horror. And specifically with Of One Blood, there's necromancy, there's bringing people back from the dead, there's, homicide, there's even sci-fi elements to that world, sort of a Black society that's super advanced, hidden away from the rest of the world, a pre-Wakandan type imagining. So when I was asked late last year to write a foreword for Of One Blood, I was incredibly flattered to know that the book's being reissued. So hopefully people can start seeing that this isn't a new space for us to be in. And having this anthology as something that may be a springboard for people to learn about those writers who have been around for centuries doing this work and writing and imagining and putting out not only speculative fiction, but work that has horrific elements or speculative elements that people tend to only place in a literary category. Hopefully people are now seeing that those books can actually be considered speculative works and we can enjoy them as those speculative works, even as we pull out those elements that may not have ever been attributed to our work before.
Yeah.
And I think that's an amazing thing to have happen right now that we are experiencing.
Yeah, definitely. Out of interest, Of One Blood, you say it's by Pauline Hopkins?
Yes.
I'm trying to think. I think I may have read that. Is that the one where they go on the archaeological dig?
Yes. It's Of One Blood or The Hidden Self, I believe is the full title.
Yeah, I did a course years ago that I think I read it on. I've got, you know when you hear a title and you just get that little flicker at the back of your brain. I think I've come across that, but I'll certainly like hunt it down and do a bit more research and put it in the show notes because that sounds fascinating. Anyone else any thoughts on this before we move on?
Ceresia here. I just wanted to quickly jump in from sort of like the publisher's marketing perspective. I think a lot of books sometimes are, you know, bisect differently because it's kind of like what's on trend and what's selling now. So I know sometimes publishers tend to also move the key themes around based on like what's trending. And I think right now we're sort of in a horror age where it's trending again and it's coming back. And that's thanks to, of course, all of the lovely films and other writers who are writing horror. But I think particularly right now, we're seeing authors of color finally get put in the spotlight in this genre. And I think so many people are clamoring for that representation. And so, you know, when we were thinking about this anthology and yes, horror with a capital H, that was really important because some of these stories could be classified as dark fantasy or could just be classified as science fiction, right? Like you mentioned Courtney Nash's story, someone mm-hmm. could just, you know, categorize that as like, oh, this is a sci-fi story. Yes, but it's a space horror. So it's important to put the horror aspect to it. And so definitely that was always top of mind for Desiree and I. And also just to remind folks that, sure, it has speculative aspects, but is actually centered in horror. Like that's where we want to keep the lens of the themes here and have all of those other supernatural things that are happening being part of it. But yeah, I'm hoping that we get to see more of the genre expand. I'm hoping that people will rethink what horror is because of the diverse stories in this collection. I think some people will probably read it and be like, oh, I would have never thought of, you know, psychological story really being horror, but no, it is. It's a, you know, a subgenre within the genre. So I hope that the diversity of the stories remind people that horror cannot just be one type of story, that there are other genres within it.
It's interesting thinking of that from a marketing perspective or a trend perspective, because I'm also now thinking of the way that people in like writing communities or MFAs are sort of taught to package their work. And I don't know if I would have considered myself a horror writer early on. I think gothic was said by mentors a few times, which is basically horror with like a literary kiss, I guess.
Yeah, Monica, it's exactly that. You know, they're always wondering like, what are the other things that could be captured by this? And I think also when it comes to horror, though, for the longest time, I feel like it was kind of like the romance genre where people were like, oh, this is not really considered like fiction unless you were Stephen King. Then they're like, okay, it's considered a, you know, a pretty big deal, but I think it's changing. And the more writers who come on the scene and expand it, I think people are starting to change their minds. But I agree with you, you know, writing my own stories, people are like, oh, what kind of writer are you? And I'm like, I don't know. I like speculative stuff, which is why I think speculative probably came up a lot during this conversation for many of us, because it kind of encapsulates a lot of the different types of genre, right? Like fantasy, sci-fi, horror, gothic, all of those things.
All of which are covered on this show at length. You know, horror and scary fiction is a very, very broad church. But something that isn't covered very often is YA. So I've had a handful of sort of self-defined YA authors. I did a special last year all about middle grade authors, and there's some more middle grade authors coming later this year. But generally speaking, I've done stuff that hasn't had that category attached to it. This does. On the back cover, it says these are YA stories. And to be honest with you, if that wasn't on the jacket copy, I don't think I would have thought of these as young adult stories. They're all about young people, but they don't pull many punches. And I wonder, you know, Eden, I know that you often, you know, typically write for a younger audience. Monica, you don't. Your debut was an adult gothic novel. Did the YA tag change how you approached the project?
I guess I'll jump in. This is Eden. I've written adult work, short stories. My novels are middle grade novels. So being invited into a YA project really was a new space for me. But at the time, I had just sold a YA Southern Gothic horror novel. And at the time, it hadn't been announced. It's been announced now. So it was a space where I'd dipped my toe in, but I hadn't had any work come out that was for a YA age group. So it was really finding my feet and finding the difference in a protagonist that was younger versus older. You want to find a space where the character is still unsure about some things, or they're not completely necessarily worldly. They don't always necessarily come at problems and concerns in a way that adults might do it, but they're still beyond, say, the middle grade 8 to 12, 13 range. So it was a challenge for me and an opportunity to really spread my wings and find a place that felt right, that I hadn't written in, and hopefully create a story that was unsettling, but in a gothic kind of way. And I appreciate so much what others have said on the call, widening the definition of horror and being able to move it away from it's just a slasher chasing you through a campground, because horror is so much more than that. And people have told me that they don't like horror, but they like what I write, because they have this misconception that horror is slasher and that's it. So trying to find my footing with YA, but still crafting a story that felt right for the anthology, it was a wonderful opportunity. But certainly I had to come at it from a different method of attack than my other work.
I had a similar experience to Eden. I didn't really have experience writing YA, and I sort of spiraled initially. I was like, well, how do I find the age of this voice? I think initially the character sounded too young, maybe. And I don't think it had changed my approach much, but I definitely was panicking. And I was like, can I cuss? So I can even, what do they think about? But then I sort of remembered, like, the experience of fear as a young adult can seem much more consuming, or maybe it's just the memory of it. But I think with that in mind, it sort of makes the horror genre within IA feel, or YA feel, more accessible to all ages.
I'm really happy you brought up the topic of voice. But this is where I run the risk of asking a stupid question. Because one of the things I noticed, right, here's what I was going to say. Right? I was going to say, I noticed how authentic the voices sound in each of your four stories. Then I realized I'm the last person who should be speaking about what is an authentic voice for a young female black teen, right? It's just a ridiculous thing for me to be saying. But I happen to be reading this book when I watched the movie American Fiction. So I was just primed to be thinking about voice and tone. And because you are writing about, you know, young people, did vernacular and speech pattern become important or a challenge? Because that seems to be something that white writers only do if they are really aiming for something highbrow and experimental, or like uber literary, like, you know, Irvine Welsh in Trainspotting, for example, with his Scottish demotic. Was it a challenge to grasp that young vernacular? Was it important to your stories? I know you don't all do it, but some of you do.
Yeah, I can jump in here. This is Ceresia. You know, my story is set in the Bronx, New York, and I think Bronx teens definitely speak a very certain way. Well, just New York teens in general. And so that was really important to me, to make sure that, you know, teens specifically from New York, really the Bronx, who are going to pick up this story and read it, I want them to feel seen, because I was trying to do a few things in this story. You know, my story, I think I bring in more humor because I'm very much horror and humor. I like that type of horror. I wanted to make sure that came across, but also I felt like within the publishing industry, there's not a lot of stories that are set in the Bronx. There is not a lot of stories that feature, you know, a Black Afro-Latina, especially within horror. So, you know, I was trying to sort of focus on those experiences and what it would be like being a teen in that specific setting. So for me, the dynamic that my main character, you know, Allie, has with her friends was really important. How they're joking, you know, they're all on the track team and they have sort of their own sort of inside jokes and stuff like that. So I wanted to make sure that that came across. So I think my story was one of the stories that had maybe a little bit more dialogue, and I wanted to make sure that that was reflected as accurately as possible.
Well, let's jump into the stories. Because as everyone, I do these round tables, we can't really talk at length about specific stories. We have to do justice to the anthology as a whole. But I do want to touch on each of your stories before we finish, because they're all so individually interesting. Let's start with yours, Ceresia, because you brought it up. You know, yours is easily the most comedic of the four, and I think the most lighthearted and breezy of the entire anthology. It's called Cemetery Dance Party. It's your take on the zombie uprising. And it reads like a sort of semi-meta restaging of Michael Jackson's Thriller video.
It really is. I think you're the first reader who got that.
Oh, good. Yeah, there's a bit where you talk about the Thriller video and that your characters are talking about it. And then ghouls start rising. And it's the part where I was like, oh, I get this, is when one of the smoke machines gets knocked over and it becomes the Thriller video.
Basically, I have to say, you were like one of the only people who picked up on this. I think my story, like you said, is really cheesy. I am not like one of those.
I didn't call it cheesy. I said it was lighthearted and breezy.
I'm calling it cheesy myself because I think all of the stories in this collection, you know, while I was editing them, because I wrote my story sort of last. I always like to do that when I'm working on anthologies because, you know, if I do my story first, I'm like, oh, I can't contribute something that's missing from the collection. So I like to edit everyone else's story. And there was a lot of things happening in the collection already. And I was like, no one's really giving me that R.L. Stine, you know, nostalgic 90s kind of that era for me. And so I'm glad you picked up on my story, because I've been waiting for readers to discover that. I'm like, this is so on the nose. Like, you're having a dance party at a cemetery, you know, you're playing Michael Jackson's Thriller, the kids are dancing to it, and then there's like a zombie outbreak. Like, you know, it's the funniest thing. But yeah, I am really big into humor when it comes to horror. I really enjoy stuff like that. Like, I like all types of horror, to be honest. So I know Desiree mentioned Ripley and Alien earlier. So that's definitely in my wheelhouse. I don't know if folks have watched Severance on Apple TV, but I love stuff like that where, you know, it's psychological horror, slashers, things that are going to make you think. A huge fan of Jordan Peele, huge fan of Tanana Reevdu, and all of these fantastic writers. And then I'm like, oh, well, I don't know if I can do those things with the craft. But when I think of horror, I think of like that humor reprieve, you know, like there are bad things happening, but then I like to see people laughing. And so that's what I was doing with my story.
You know what it made me think of? Here's a weird comparison. It made me think of the Michael J. Fox classic Teen Wolf. It's that level of sort of high school pastiche comedy gruesomeness. Yeah. And it did feel like a welcome breath. It felt like when you watch a horror movie and there's a joke at some point and you feel the audience just relax a little bit. That's what your story felt like in this anthology, which, as I've already covered, is pretty damn scary. Desiree, Monica, Eden, your three stories had something in common. They're very different stories, but one thing that connected them is the presence of legend, folklore, the importance of knowledge being passed down through generations. And in yours, in particular, Desiree, The Brides of Devil's Bayou, it's just full of lore from, you know, the protagonist's grandmother going backwards with this curse in this family. But also you mention like Slender Man and Trevor Henderson's upside down face and Siren Head. Are you a kind of folklore urban legend nut like I am?
I am. And I wanted this story in a lot of ways to be a shout out to that. The story actually went through a few different versions, but they all were kind of in that kind of folkloric urban legend monster kind of imagining. And I ended up just kind of settling on this tale because I really wanted to do something. I had in mind to do something that was about kind of generational trauma and how do I kind of like use the supernatural to actually make generational trauma manifest. And that came to me through this idea of this demon that had been attached to this family for generations. So I was able to really kind of play with this idea of stories that we tell in our families, stories that communities tell. I'm from a small town that has all these urban legends and ideas of curses that are really attached to, like, really, when you actually investigate them. I grew up in a small town in Louisiana. They're attached to some kind of really traumatic events that happened in the past in this place, right? Because the soil is just so many, it's just so full of a lot of real life terrors and stories. And so all of that kind of inspired this story. So how do I take these kind of real life happenings, this runaway slave girl story? How do I take this idea of us carrying these curses on our backs without even really kind of understanding and realizing it? And then how do I have my final girl face that head on and win in the end? I went back to this idea of also thinking about the folkloric and legend that really kind of also appears in both Monica and Eden stories. When we think about horror, sometimes we that's a piece that we don't often think about as kind of an origin story for a lot of horror, is we kind of mention in kind of outlining this anthology, you know, horror can go back to our campfire stories, our folklore, our legends. Black horror dates back that far, you know. I think about so much, when I think about like Eden story, I think about African diaspora, I think about our folk tales, I think about the ways that so many of those legends had these kind of ideas of like haints and witches and curses and magic. And, you know, this idea of these kind of gods and the grotesque in them, right? And that too inspires a lot of the Black horror, you know, so we can have our social horror and our kind of our racial horror, which has kind of been popularized by Jordan Peele's work, but we can also have these kind of folkloric horror monsters, demons that go back generations and generations and generations in the kind of Black tradition as well. And how do we kind of bring those kind of stories to the forefront?
Yeah, and you do it in a way that is machine tooled to freak me out, because it's all about demons that attack you in the night when you're asleep and all manner of creepy stuff. I really like your story. This was the first one I read in the collection going through. I was like, this could easily be lifted out and not be a YA story at all. I get that it is, but it doesn't need to be in any way. It's a full-blooded sort of folkloric horror story. And I will say, I've been to quite a lot of the United States, and Louisiana is by far the spookiest of them.
Yeah, absolutely. Like, Louisiana is a spooky, haunted place, and I love using it in my work. That's where I grew up. That's where, you know, I heard the scary stories told to me sitting out on the porch. The swamp is just a moody, dark place that inspires me to want to write into its past and present. And so I really wanted to bring that all into this piece as I thought about, like, how do I tell a story of the past, but also tell a story of the present. And through this idea of, like, how do Black women survive? What kind of sometimes feels the impossible.
Yeah. And I'm trying to think about everything you said about Eden's work a minute ago, because Eden, I'm always looking to find new monsters and stories and lore and traditions through horror. I think it's one of the beautiful things this genre can do. And in your story, Local Colour, you introduce the Plateye.
Yes.
Now, that's a term I've heard before, but never really expanded upon. And you mention it's, you know, unique to your cultural background. Can you tell us a little about all of that and why you chose to frame your story around this particular concept?
Well, I chose a folkloric monster from my background because, well, I knew I was coming into a space with a lot of authors that were absolutely amazing, and I wanted to come with a story that could be something that I would contribute that possibly no one else would, because I think it's important for an anthology to have variations. So I wanted to come to a party, so to speak, with something that I was very familiar with, that I could craft into a story that might be a little different from all the other stories. So that was really the impetus for choosing something from my background like that.
And what is the Plateye? Tell us about it.
Just, you know, long story short, I could talk about, you know, folkloric monsters for ages. It's essentially a shapeshifter character. It's true form, which is something that I very loosely describe in the story. But essentially, it draws you in because it takes the shape of something or someone that you're very familiar with. Part of what Verone experiences in Local Colour is it takes the shape of someone that she has a crush on. And she does get her first kiss in the story, which was, you know, my attempt to make sure that it felt very YA, mm-hmm. and that it felt of the experiences and how she reacts to that particular experience felt like someone of that age reacting to it, and then wrapping the horror around something that should be such a sweet, warm memory for the average person, and taking it down that dark path. So essentially, it can look like something so familiar and so comforting, especially when you're already in the midst of a horrific situation. And that's the way that it pulls you in. It looks like safety. It looks like familiarity, until you realize and notice what's off. And shapeshifters are sort of one of the monsters that I always think is a really terrifying thing, because, you know, you don't always know. And each time it gets a little bit better at impersonating.
That's the creepy thing. It learns.
Yes, it learns, and it learns what it did wrong the last time. It doesn't make the same mistake.
It's funny actually you say that about shapeshifting, because there's more than one story in this collection. Mm-hmm. Where I'm thinking of the first two, Harvester and Welcome Back to the Cosmos, where they both end, yes, the character has survived, and like yours, Eden, but she hasn't necessarily defeated the creature, and in fact the creature may be very nearby in the guise of somebody who up until now was a trusted sort of friend or family member. That's only just occurred to me that is a thing that connects several of these stories, but the shapeshifter gets quite close to you and is still there at the end. Survival doesn't necessarily mean a happy ending, does it?
Exactly.
I think that's definitely true. And I feel like it really does really reflect a lot of our experiences in the world now. Going back to some of our earlier discussions about how these stories reflect the Black experience in the world, there's that shadow or that shape or that figure that's always there somewhere, closer sometimes than you think. And in a lot of ways, that's the real horror of it.
Yeah. And I think about another story in the collection, Chimera's story, I think also had a folkloric shapeshifter, which is similar to the Gullah culture's hag, which was this Caribbean version of it. And so that idea of, you know, that folkloric shape-shifting character, which I think is very much a prevalent character in a lot of Black folklore.
Something for a research scholar to look into, no doubt. Lastly, we come to you, Monica. You wrote the scariest story in the collection. It's called The Skittering Thing, and I'm not sure there is a creepier word than skitter in the English language. Nothing good has or ever will skitter. And whilst the stories we've discussed, you know, they use urban legend, they reframe urban legend and folklore, yours is the story that feels most like its own urban legend, with this creepy game and this weird family that releases something terrible. You've mentioned a dream. I'd love to know more about where the idea for this came from, where the idea for the actual game itself came from, because it's so unnerving.
Okay. So the creature, as I said, came from a nightmare. And what scared me most about the creature in each time that it appears is that it's sensed before it arrives. So it's like sort of inherently a part of the world, and I guess a part of me and my subconscious, which reminds me of growing up like Southern Baptist and the very God-fearing centered sermons and like the threat of hell and being inherently a sinner, and how that sort of serves the patriarchal, or it serves the men more than women, I would say. So I don't know, they seem connected thematically to me. The game actually is a game that I played as a child. I didn't go back to that person's house after that.
Oh wow, it wasn't like your own family. You went to someone's house and played this game?
Yes.
Oh my god.
In the middle of rural Tennessee, so just thick mountain.
Monica, dark. I don't think Desiree and I knew that this was inspired by true events. So that's very spooky.
Oh wow! Like when listeners read that story, they will think of you. How old were you when you played this game?
Oh goodness, maybe too old to have been as scared as I was. But once the lights are out.
I'm 40 years old. I would be terrified now to play that game with a strange family in a strange house. I'm not giving the game details away to the listener because it's too lovely to read about without knowing. So, but wow. I mean, at one point, there is that wonderful detail where someone gets licked in the dark by what they think is the dog. And then they see the dog is outside and it's just complete nightmare fuel. But it's interesting you talk about, you know, your religious Baptist roots and the patriarchy and all that, because one of the details I noticed in this book that struck me as interesting is that it's actually the final girl's lack of faith that becomes armor that saves her in a way. And that felt like an unexpected direction for a story of this type.
Oh, yes. I just thought maybe playing with the way that some churches in the South, I guess, use that fear as a sort of method of power or a guiding principle anyway. I thought, what if it were flipped on the head? Mm-hmm. And it's maybe good that she doesn't associate with the things that scare her. So it's a creepy ending maybe, but a happy one.
Yeah. Yes. Yeah. As so many of these stories are, they end creepily but happily. Well, I mean, it's been lovely to speak to you about your stories, but I always close this podcast. Normally, it's just one guest, so we can kind of belabor the point. But usually I close it by asking my guests to recommend a book that they think, or a story that they think my listeners would enjoy. Now, there's four of you here. You don't all need to do it if you don't want, but does anyone off the top of their head have a recommendation for my listeners on something they should read?
Well, I was thinking of Final Girls the other day, and I was thinking about how I grew up as a teen loving Buffy the Vampire Slayer, which is kind of the ultimate Final Girl of the 90s. But, you know, as it was, it wasn't the best around race and diversity. And, you know, the Black Slayer gets killed and like, all the Black, you know, we were often not there. But there was a series that was written by, again, kind of raising up the stories of Black women horror writers, a woman named Ellie Banks. She passed away several years ago, but she wrote this series called the Vampire Huntress Legend Series. The first book is called Minion. And it was kind of during the boom of kind of paranormal fiction, urban fantasy with a lot of the shifters and werewolves and vampires in the 2000s. And it might have gotten missed by a lot of folks, but it was one of the first really African-American centric kind of Black lore filled paranormal series that featured a terrific Black young female warrior slash slayer slash hunter, had a lot of great romance and vampires and just, you know, a lot of all the things that we loved about that era of woman-led female empowerment kind of slayer kind of stories. And Ellie Banks really did so much amazing things with that series that I feel like is often not talked about in vampire series lore, but it's one of my favorites of that era.
Thank you. I know for a fact I have lots of listeners who love that kind of series, so that's a good recommendation. Well, as I say, it's been a pleasure. We've navigated this despite there being five of us on the call, and I think this book is a little marvel, to be honest. I've been tweeting everywhere that, you know, if Blumhouse or Monkey Paw or any of the streamers are looking for their next themed anthology series, they could do a lot worse than option the stories from this book. I think you can imagine it as kind of like a Twilight Zone type series, right? On Shudder, it'd be great. It would be great. And it makes a great companion piece to Jordan Peele's Out There Screaming as well.
It does, yeah.
And I'll just say to my listeners as well, on the Patreon, because I'm never too proud to plug, on the Patreon I did quite a lengthy conversation with Dr. Robin Means-Coleman and Mark Harris about their non-fiction book, The Black Guy Dies First, which is all about how horror cinema has mistreated Black characters and Black filmmakers over the year. And I really think that this collection is a nice antidote to a similar problem. So it's out now by the time this podcast goes live, and I hope it does brilliantly. But Monica, Eden, Ceresia, and Desiree, thank you so much for taking the time to talk Scared.
Thank you.
Thanks.
My pleasure. Thank you for having us.
This was an awesome conversation.
Well, I hope you enjoyed that as much as I did. Great conversation, great book, necessary book, but without getting too bogged out of the politics of it, just a fun book to read. I worry that perhaps I bit off more than I could really chew having four guests, because I would have liked to have dig deeper into each of the stories in more detail, give them the chance to expound further. But I didn't want to have a 3-hour podcast. But in particular, I wish I'd brought Monica into the conversation more, because her story, the skittering thing, oh my God. If I say it's like a YA equivalent of Laird Barron's Tiptoe, then those of you who know will rush to read it. And those who don't know should read it and then read Laird Barron's Tiptoe. But all of the stories in The Black Girl Survives in this one have something about them. A charm, a vitality, a variety. There's such a wealth of imagination on display. And okay, the YA tone does mitigate some of the horror in a few of them. And there are some that I think would benefit from another few thousand words to really flesh out their premise. But as an anthology overall, it's a winner. It's a great companion piece, as we said at the end, to Jordan Peele's Out There Screaming. And if you have spooky kids or spooky teens in your life, I think they'll like it. And in particular, it's a great way to introduce kids to the diversity of horror that we're always trying to celebrate on this show and in our reading. Now, on that theme, as I mentioned at the end of the episode, you can find more conversation about that topic over on the Patreon channel. This is not the hard sell, honest, it's just a particularly relevant thing this week, because the conversation I recorded last year with Dr. Coleman and Mark Harris about black representation in horror is very much a part of the conversation we had this week. And you can find that and everything else you want at patreon.com/talkingscaredpod. I don't have much more to update you on this week, to be honest. It's been a slower one for a change, which has been nice, though I am busily working away on introducing merch. I'm thinking t-shirts, hoodies, mugs and bookmarks. I want to see people out in the wilds of elsewhere wearing this logo. What a mad thrill that would be. I'll update on social media and the website as and when I know more. And you can find me on Twitter and Instagram and Threads and all the rest at TalkScaredPod, or email me at TalkingScaredPod@gmail.com. And if you've got thoughts on merch, let me know, because I have zero idea what I'm doing, but I plan to make it good. I always plan to make things good. I hope, mostly, it is good. And next week's certainly is, because I'm back with one of the most unique and enigmatic books that I've read in this year so far. It's The Underhistory by Karen Warren, a mix of home invasion crime thriller and ghost story, though neither of those ingredients takes the form you would really expect. It's a properly interesting book and conversation, so do check back for that. But until then, take that chance you're mulling over. Book that trip you want to take. Live to live, not just survive. Read good books, and remember, it's good to be scared.